Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in November 2024. This session looked at positive nutrition for cognitive health, examining the latest trends and functional ingredients shaping the market. Your host is the Professor of Exercise and Obesity at Leeds Beckett University, Paul Gately.
So this session is on positive nutrition for cognitive health. Our first speaker is Matthew, who's going to be talking about nutrition for the menopausal brain. We've then got Katrina, who's going to be speaking about clever polyphenols. And then finally, we've got Andy, who's going to be speaking about Better You.
So hello, everyone. My name is Matthew Pontifex. I'm a researcher at the University of Dangler. It's a pleasure to be here today to talk you through an area of research that's very active in my lab at the moment. So I specialize on sex differences in the context of nutrition and cognitive health in particular. And obviously one of those areas is nutrition and the area of the menopausal brain. I'm going to give you a bit of an overview, a bit of background about sex differences. I've been nicely introduced because actually there's a lot of crossover between the sports nutrition. So I'll give you a little bit of an overview, a little bit of insight into some of the changes in menopause from a biochemical perspective. And then give you a little bit of evidence about some potential nutritional strategies. But similar to the talk before, this is really in its infancy. So there's a lot of, you know, products out there, but the evidence isn't quite there yet. And that's what we're working on in my lab at the moment. So falls under, as I say, we've had this nicely introduced. So this is just revision now. Falls under nutrigenetics, nutrigenomics. Nutrigenetics being how our genetic makeup influences the way we respond to certain foods. Nutrigenomics, how certain foods influence gene expression. And you can see from the diagram on the right-hand side, or my right-hand, no, that side, left-hand side for you, that basically our diet is metabolized and we produce metabolites which influence gene expression. Similarly, it can go through and modulate the gut microbiota, which can then influence the metabolites produced, which can then in turn influence gene expression again. So, as I said, I'm interested in how sex differences influence nutrition and health, particularly in the context of the brain. We have a nice review article looking at sex differences in the context of nutrition and health at the moment. It's currently paper of the month at the Nutrition Society. So if you're interested in this, please do look into this in some more detail. But essentially, sex differences do ultimately, to some extent, come down to genetic differences when we're talking about biological sex. And essentially what we say in this review is it's a very understudied area, but some of the emerging evidence shows that there is real big changes in the way metabolism occurs across males and females. And this can have profound effects, particularly in the brain. So these metabolic alterations can increase our risk or decrease our risk for certain health conditions, such as cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, dementia. And we would hope to come in and use precision nutrition strategies based on what we know from the metabolic alterations to try and improve and ameliorate these diseases. And as has been mentioned, actually, in one of the previous slides by Sam, it's really important because these changes are not static across the lifespan. They're very dynamic. So we need to be looking at this across the lifespan. And one of those big differences is the menopause, which I'll be discussing over the next few slides. But just before that, I just want to highlight these sex differences a little bit further. So this is a very easy study that we did, very basic in an animal model. And it's basically looking at different dietary fibers across males and females. And this is the microbiome. So we have alpha diversity on that side, the left, right-hand side. I can't get that around from here. Anyway. On the microbiome, alpha diversity, which is essentially showing species richness, by basically what's there. And you can see if we feed, these are soluble dietary fibers, we've got inulin, psyllium, and a combination of the two. If we supplement with inulin in this animal model, we see a big change in species richness in the females, and we see no change in the males. So that's why we need these sorts of precision nutrition strategies, because this may be having metabolic changes that could be preluding to various diseases. Similarly, if we look at the beta diversity, which is basically showing how dissimilar each sample is to one another, we can see that we get massive changes in response to the various dietary fibers, and we also get a nice split across males and females in response to these different dietary fibers. Now, the most interesting one of this, you may have caught your attention, is the psyllium group, which shows no difference in males and females, which shows that that's having potentially such a robust effect on the microbiome that it's basically getting rid of the sex differences. But it's really important that we study this in more detail, because not enough studies are showing this divide between males and females. And we see similar things in the brain. We can see some 6,000 genes differentially expressed in the brain just in response to these different dietary fibers. And if we, obviously there's a lot going on there, but if we simplify this to a PCA plot, we can see that there's some differences across sex in regards to the diet. The one that's most interesting is the psyllium, again, with the females having a completely different response in the brain compared to the males. And we know that there's sex differences associated with the development of dementias and Alzheimer's disease. So females, we can safely say, have a greater prevalence of Alzheimer's disease compared to males. Whether they have an increased risk is a little bit more up for debate at this moment in time. There's some studies, such as the one I'm showing here on the graph, that shows there is an increased risk, but there's other studies out there that show that this increased risk is fairly minimal, if not. And the reason for potentially some of these differences also relate to the sex differences I talked about previously, but also this could relate to societal differences as well. But regardless of whether there's an increased risk or not, I do believe that the mechanisms by which these neurodegenerative conditions develop are likely to be different across males and females. And so one, as I mentioned before, one big difference in sex is that females undergo the menopause transition, which is essentially 12 months absence of menstruation. And you can see there's a massive change in the hormone profile, particularly during the perimenopause phase, where we see fluctuations in some of the levels of these hormones. So that's a really interesting area for future intervention, but also a big change from premenopausal to postmenopausal. And the most compelling evidence for this increased risk in Alzheimer's disease, dementias, in response to menopause is that essentially those who undergo the menopause transition at a much earlier age have a much increased risk of developing dementia later in life. So there's a target population that really needs some sort of treatment in the future. And we're interested in trying to understand the mechanisms for this. And there's a nice study here that shows one of the big changes is glucose metabolism. So this is an FDG PET image of the menopausal brain. And you can see hypometabolism of glucose within the brain in premenopausal to postmenopausal women. Obviously, a big issue with this, though, is that uncoupling age from the menopausal transition is quite a difficult thing to do, and that's why we need animal models to do this. And we've been working in animal models to try and understand what's going on in the brain. So this is RNA-seq analysis, so gene expression analysis in the brain, in the hippocampus and the cortex of essentially menopausal mice. And we can see that, again, we see the changes in mitochondrial function within the brain, alluding to those changes in glucose metabolism. But we see many other pathways. It's really complex. There's some, again, some 4,000 genes changed with differences across the hippocampus and the cortex, suggesting that there's regional specificity to this. To summarize some of the things that we see and also what some of the things that other people see, we've got a nice overview of some of the changes. There's more to it than this. This is what is published at the moment, but we're working on some other pathways. But we see changes in neurotrophic factors, changes in mitochondrial function, changes in inflammation, changes in tight junction proteins, and blood-brain barrier integrity. And then we also talked about the glucose, and of particular interest to us is the change in lipids within the brain, which I'll just touch upon when we talk about treatment strategies. But I'll put these arrows in to suggest that essentially, if we have nutritional strategies, we could come in at many different points of this to try and alleviate the symptoms or risk of cognitive decline. Unfortunately, at the moment, this is an area in its infancy. There's really not much high-quality evidence at this moment in time. So this is just a really simple PubMed search I did in preparation for this presentation. And essentially, there's just putting in these menopause, nutrition, brain. I also did the same with cognition. Reveals some only 85 studies, maybe 9 clinical trials. And this is in line with this recent meta-analysis study, which shows that their conclusions were that nutritional strategies could be possible, but we're, again, in our infancy, and there's not much evidence. There's a lot of heterogeneity out there. And that was looking at anxiety and depression, which is obviously very common in menopause transition. So now looking at some interventions, and I say take this with a pinch of salt because obviously there's not much evidence out there, but I'm just going to give you a summary of what I found having a quick look through the literature and some of the knowledge that I know at the moment. So plant polyphenols, we're going to get, I imagine, a much better explanation of this later, the plant polyphenols. You would hypothesize that inflammation, synaptic plasticity, and potentially gut microbiota remodeling may have an impact. But when we look at the information at this moment in time, there's surprisingly minimal research in this field, and it really needs further research. The two that you can see that are particularly mentioned in the literature are resveratrol and soy isoflavones, which I'll talk on the next slide. But apart from that, I could only find information about cocoa, which seemed to potentially improve cognitive performance. This was quite a large randomized control trial on this side. And then they found a change in cognition, an improvement in cognition in postmenopausal women. And that's another factor we need to take into consideration, that there's different time points of the menopause. So obviously, if we hit the perimenopause phase, we might get different results compared to postmenopausal. And another study found that essentially this was linked to cerebrovascular function improvements, but they didn't actually find an improvement in cognition. The two mentioned before, resveratrol and soy isoflavones, are phytoestrogens. So phytoestrogens are essentially plant compounds with some structural similarity to estradiol. And these have the ability to cause estrogenic or anti-estrogenic effects. So these would be really nice if you could come in at the top of this and try and ameliorate a lot of these symptoms at the same time. But one of the issues found with resveratrol is there's only two studies I could find on resveratrol in postmenopausal women, and they showed slight improvements in cognition and vascular function as well. Whereas the soy isoflavones, unfortunately, the majority of those studies show no effect. Another potential intervention, given the change in glucose metabolism within the brain, could be caloric restriction. There's a small amount of preclinical data for this, but when looking at human studies, it's very limited. The one study I was able to find showed an improvement in cognition in response to caloric restriction. But interestingly, a lot of the changes were lost after the weight was maintained. So it was more about that weight loss process rather than the maintenance of a weight loss. So to me, that suggests there's something else going on. Could be cellular stress responses, but it does bring to mind to me potentially ketones, given that that is the secondary fuel of the brain. If we're having problems with glucose metabolism in the brain, maybe we're shifting to a more ketone fuel use, and maybe that could benefit from that. One that I'm particularly interested in is N3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, so particularly DHA. So these are found in oily fish sources, and these are highly concentrated within the brain, particularly in the cortex. And you can see from this diagram, it hits many different pathways within the brain. And of particular interest in our animal models of menopause, we see DHA levels dropping within the brain. So supplementation may be advantageous. And there's not much, obviously, human data at this moment in time suggesting polyunsaturated fatty acids have a benefit in menopausal women. But I was able to find one in one study, one human study, looking at postmenopausal individuals, showing that those with higher levels of N3 polyunsaturated fatty acids, such as DHA and EPA, actually had higher hippocampal and brain volumes compared to those that had a lower. Vitamins, there's some preclinical evidence for A, C, and D, but this largely relates to inflammation, but no real RCT evidence in postmenopausal women. And this is looking, again, specifically at the brain, not other like osteoporosis, etc. And finally, just to talk about pre and probiotics. So the evidence that the menopause changes the gut microbiome at this moment in time, I think, is quite weak. Looking at papers to paper, there's a lot of differences from the literature, and I don't think there's a consensus on these changes at the moment. But that doesn't necessarily mean that probiotics won't have any impact. It could be sort of having a protective effect, potentially. But there's certainly, at this moment in time, no evidence for a benefit on the brain. And these are some of our animal models of menopause, which show essentially no... Oh, didn't realize I had that. That show basically no difference in alpha diversity again. So these are the menopausal ones. These ones, the red ones. These are menopausal ones here and menopausal ones across there. There's no real difference in any alpha diversity across any of our experimentations. So to conclude, nutrition for the mental brain is in its infancy. There is proof of concept from some preclinical studies, but more research, particularly high quality RCT evidence, is required and needed.
What a great start to this session. Thank you, Matthew. So moving on to Katrina.
Okay, so my talk is going to be focused on flavonoids, which are a subgroup of polyphenols and the impact on the brain. So you can find flavonoids in most plants, so throughout fruits and vegetables. There are some foods that are particularly enriched. So you might have heard of berries that are very rich in anthocyanins, and cocoa, very rich in flavanols. They tend to give some of the colors, the colorful patterns to food. So that's a good way of knowing whether you're consuming flavonoids, is looking for color. And for some of this high flavanol foods, some of the vascular effects are very well established. So we know that within a few hours of consuming a food that is rich in flavonoids, you have an improvement in elasticity of your blood vessels, very much the mechanisms related to nitric oxide and probably some other things. But to simplify, so that they are quite quick acting in the vasculature. And some of my research has been focused in trying to understand how this might benefit the brain. So there's been a few studies now, so cross-sectional and longitudinal, that suggest that if you have a diet that is habitual diet that is rich in flavonoids, that you might actually attenuate cognitive decline later in life. And there's been some interesting studies in twins. And again, this last one, so the same type of idea that there seems to be some protection there. Now, we don't understand how that works. So there's been also some few randomized controlled trials and some meta-analysis actually looking at impact of flavonoid interventions on cognitive function. And there, the literature is a little bit mixed. It seems like most of the effects tend to be from chronic interventions and in populations that are not healthy. However, we've... I'm going to show you some data from our lab that in which we were able to show quite acute effects in young, healthy adults just by really making the cognitive tasks that we're using more challenging to the population that we are testing. And so Stroop task is just a very common used cognitive function. So it measures executive function. And in the literature, you will see that some people show benefits, some people don't. In fact, what you're trying to do here, I can't point, but you basically, you're shown a color, a word that is, for example, green, that is written in a different color. And you're supposed to say the color of the word and avoid reading what it's in there, which is quite difficult to do. But actually, when you do that, after a high or low flavanol intervention, you don't see any differences in performance. But if you make it just a little bit harder by putting some color in the choices, that makes it very hard for the brain to try and figure out what it's trying to do. And in that case, you do seem to find some benefits. So it might be the issue is the way that we're measuring this benefit. So if it's easy enough, our young, healthy brains can cope with it. If it's just a bit harder, then you might get the benefit from the food. And so we think that what might be going on there is that the vasculature of the brain, when these compounds are in circulation, is just reacting a little bit more efficiently. And so one thing that we showed in this study also was that when we challenge the brain with a physiological stress like breathing CO2, which basically just makes the brain kind of react as increasing blood flow and oxygenation as much as it can to cope with that challenge, we see that the high flavanol, so we did this before and after a high and low flavanol intervention, you can see in red there that the oxygenation in the brain shoots up and it goes a lot higher after you have the high flavanol compared to the low flavanol. And this is basically the graph that reflects the average of that cerebral oxygenation. So not only the oxygenation goes higher after that physiological challenge, but also it gets to that higher level a bit faster, okay? So the time to reach maximal brain oxygenation is decreased by about a minute. And you can see that clearly in some of these brain maps. So you can see on the top, this is the time that we're subjecting the person, the volunteers, to the breathing of the CO2. So it's about 4 minutes. You have the low flavanol on top, high flavanol below. If you just focus on what happens 2 hours post the low and the high flavanol, around 2 minutes, if you follow the red arrows, you can see there is a lot more red after the high flavanol than the low flavanol. So it is being a lot more is being so the flavanol compounds within the circulation is making the brain respond more efficiently to that challenge. Now, one thing that we thought was quite interesting in this was that not all people benefited from the intake of flavanol. So there was a small group, group two below, in which it actually there was no difference between the oxygenation response in low or high flavanol. And interestingly, that group also did not benefit cognitively. Okay, the rest of the group that show that improvement in oxygenation in the brain to the physiological challenge also benefited cognitively. So what that got us thinking was that it looks like maybe those cognitive benefits are linked to this higher, faster levels of brain oxygenation. We can argue to why some people benefit and some people don't. It's an interesting question in itself, but it's just linking these two things. So the next experiment that we did was to try and look at what we called neurovascular coupling, so a model of neurovascular coupling in humans. So it's basically just having a very controlled neuronal activity, and we can do that in the visual cortex by opening the eyes and reading something and closing the eyes. So you control the neuronal activity, and then you see how the brain, the vasculature, respond to that. And let me just show you. So here is just, so when you have your eyes closed, you have the velocity of the posterior cerebral artery very low. Then you open your eyes and it kind of goes up, right? So we do this in 30 seconds increments, and then you close your eyes and it goes down. So we basically looked at the kinetics of that response after a high flavanol and a low flavanol intervention. We also always do this before and after, so acutely. So what we see this time was that that peak was not different between the two interventions, but the time to get there was reduced by about 3 seconds. Okay, so this is a way of measuring this coupling of neuronal activity and the vasculature responding to that need for oxygen and glucose in a very controlled way in humans. And we are now generating some data using a cognitive task. Those are a little bit more complex because everybody obviously generates different neuronal activity in response to a task. So that's why this is a very nice model to kind of start with. Now, one of the things that I've been interested in for a long time is that we have these compounds that we know we consume, and within a couple of hours, we can have some very measurable, consistent benefits in the peripheral vasculature. We know that. In the brain, we're still working on it. But, you know, cocoa flavanols, anthocyanins from berries, blueberries, I mean, they're very well established. And how do we take advantage of that in our daily lives? So I started thinking about behaviors within our daily lives that actually put our vasculature at risk, that make our vasculature more vulnerable. And two examples of those that we've been working on for the last few years is, for example, mental stress and sitting for long periods of time. So these are two types of behaviors that, unfortunately, we engage in quite a lot in our lives that are both associated with increased risk of disease, specifically cardiovascular disease. And the other interesting thing is that you can see the effects of these behaviors in your vasculature within a few hours after you engaged. So after you got stressed, within half an hour, you have an impairment in elasticity of your vessels. They eventually recover by an hour and a half later. But imagine that you're getting stressed constantly throughout your day. Your vasculature is constantly at loss, okay? Same thing with sitting. Within an hour of sitting, you can have declines in vascular function across your body, legs and arms. And this is also true in some cases for the brain, although some of those effects are not so well established. So really, if we were to target to eat, you know, our high flavanol portion of fruit and veg when we know that we're going to be stressed or when we know that we're going to be sitting for long periods of time, would that be beneficial? So we started to kind of work on that. And I'm going to show you some of the effects that we show in the peripheral vasculature and some of the more preliminary data that we're kind of trying to generate in the brain also. So if you sit for 2 hours, so if you look at that that's just a measure of elasticity of vessels, let's just call it that, okay? And if you sit for 2 hours, you see that there is a decline in the elasticity of those vessels. But if you had a high flavanol drink before, actually you prevent that decline, okay? And we see this consistently in the arm and the leg, so across the peripheral vasculature. If you look at the brain on this side, this is just blood flow in the carotid. So, and you can think about positive and negative blood flow. So you see that after 2 hours of sitting, you have a decline in blood flow to the brain, in your positive blood flow, but also an increase in what we call negative blood flow, which is a bad thing for the vasculature. That is almost prevented, so it didn't quite reach significance, by the high flavanol drink. And this, what it is evidencing, is that the results in the peripheral vasculature are very clear. In the brain, we need to do more work on it. I think the effects are smaller and we need bigger sample sizes. And we sort of saw something similar around stress. So I became very interested in stress because stress has quite an impact on your endolysis of your vessels within 30 minutes. You might not even remember that you're stressed. Your vessels do remember. What do we like to and tend to want to eat when we're stressed? The high fatty foods, exactly the opposite of what we should be doing. And so we did this experiment in which we stressed people out in a very controlled environment in the lab, and we gave them some fatty snack. And you can see what happens, so in red, to your vascular function, 30 minutes and 90 minutes post-stress. It gets impaired. In fact, what the fat does there is it prolongs the impact of stress in your body, so it's bad for you. If you pair that up with a high flavanol drink, it prevents that decline. And again, this was something we've just published last week, and it was a very strong effect. So if you can't resist the fatty food, it might be something you can do by just adding something that is rich in flavanols. But again, when you look at the brain, you see that trend in the high flavanol to kind of increase oxygenation in the brain during the stress, that moment of stress. But again, it doesn't quite reach significance. After doing some power analysis, I think we are about 15 volunteers down. So we need to increase sample sizes to really establish whether some of these benefits that we're seeing in the periphery are actually translatable and can translate to the brain. So a few messages to finish off. So there is some emerging evidence that suggests that flavonoid-rich diets may protect against cognitive aging. And the mechanisms, or some of the mechanisms, might be linked to modulation of cerebral vascular function. Now, I showed you some data that suggests that you can increase performance even in a young, healthy brain, as long as what that brain is doing is challenging enough, okay? And so, and you can get that benefit even within the hours after you consumed the flavonoid-rich food. We think that cognitive performance is likely driven by more efficient cerebral oxygenation, and I showed you two pieces of data that sort of suggests that within the context of a challenge to hypercapnia, so breathing CO2, but also in the context of a model of neurovascular coupling. And finally, this is one thing that I'm quite excited about, is thinking about optimizing the intake of these foods during periods in which we know that we are at high risk. And some of the examples I showed is around inactivity and psychological stress. We might be able to minimize the impact of these things in our health by just being clever about what we eat. But in terms of the effects in the brain, more work needs to be done to really establish these effects.
Brilliant. Thank you very, very much. Moving on to our last speaker of the day. No pressure, Andy.
I thought I was pushing my luck to put a picture of someone sleeping here. So an explosion. The role of, can we all hear me here? The role of positive nutrition in sleep and stress. So following two doctors is no pressure at all. But I wanted to take a step back. And I think it's fair to say that we're all here because we all have a passion in positive nutrition, and there's not one of us who wouldn't benefit from elevated sleep or a reduction in stress. But to understand this, we really have to start with understanding our biochemistry and understanding how it's affected by the environmental journey that we're on. So maybe we should start there. We're in fact start here, as we're currently at the epicenter of what was the Industrial Revolution, about 1750. So a little over 250 years ago, the Industrial Revolution started. And this marked a milestone in human development. For the first time, we had mass rural displacement. For the first time in our species history, the majority of us were displaced from a rural environment into conurbations. The industrialization of food production. Yeah, we had fewer people producing food. So that food had to be produced with fewer resources, it had to last longer and travel further. We had a largely internal existence from 16 hours outside. A lot of us had 24 hours inside. And there was an enhanced dominance of time pressure. We really moved from time creators to time savers. And then now, time slaves. So the result, virtually overnight, our species became largely internalized and our nutritional intake became marginalized. And if we think about our time on the planet, let's say 250,000 years, give or take, and we turn that into 24 hours, this recent phenomenon, the Industrial Revolution, really happened in the last 80 seconds. We have simply not had time enough to react and cope with this phenomenon, the dramatic change in our environment. So what does that mean? So we're talking about stress and sleep, and I see them as pretty much synonymous. The more stressed we are, the poorer the quality of our sleep. The poorer the quality of our sleep, the more we seem to suffer from stress. And as we've just heard very eloquently, our brain pretty much controls how we manage our stress and how we manage our sleep. And this is a neat show of what happens in our brain. While awake, beta waves are pretty active. Alpha waves take over when we're relaxed, start to get a bit sleepy. It smooths out. Then theta waves, when we start light sleep, and you can see the sleep spindles there, which I'll talk about in a minute. But then the theta waves give way to delta waves, deep sleep. This is really nirvana. This is where we're aiming at. But we have to go through this process in order to get there. So looking at the importance of light sleep, and we shouldn't underestimate the importance of light sleep. It enables us to organize our thoughts, yeah? To control the stress, to manage what we've learned in the day. And we do it in a way that we are aware, or at least semi-aware, of external threats. This is at a time, obviously, when we might be eaten by a tiger or whatever the Manchester equivalent would be. It's an essential part of our neuroplasticity and our memory and consolidation. So these sleep spindles, these K-complexes, are an important part of light sleep, but they can be negatively affected by psychiatric disorders, so anxiety, chronic stress, illness, and chronic discomfort. They disrupt that process. And medication, and we know that really anybody over the age of 65 probably suffers from a polypharma of medication. I think if you're over the age of 65, there's a 70% chance that you may be on three types of medication. And we know that medication can interrupt the process of light sleep. For example, if you've got diabetes, you might be on metformin. Metformin, for example, will knock out certain things like omega-3 and B12. And your brain has to compensate for that. If you're on proton pump inhibitors, antacids, we know that will knock out levels of magnesium. Your brain has to compensate for that. But let's say successfully you get through light sleep and you now enter a process of deep sleep. This is what we are all aiming for, deep sleep. It's the state where we rebuild and we repair. Our bone and cell tissue is in a constant state of regeneration and repair, but the vast majority of this is done while we sleep. Just the same as our production of melatonin. 80% of this happens at night. This controls our circadian rhythm. Deep sleep is where we repair our tissue. We restore energy through a process of ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Memory consolidation, immune system strengthening, brain cleansing, hormone regulation. All happen during deep sleep. But in order to understand the brain's process of this and the nutritional impact of this, we have to understand that our body is a closed system. So how we nourish ourselves, the physical and mental stress we put our bodies under, will define the quality of sleep and the subsequent stress burden upon waking. You can only use what you've got. So suboptimal levels of essential nutrients required for repair, a poorly functioning immune system, really, really important, and physical and mental stress all interfere with how well we enter that deep sleep state and how long we're in there for. And they all divert oxygen away from the brain. And we know this because if you think about when you eat late, yeah, you feel sluggish. You do feel tired, but you don't sleep well. Yeah. When you lie down, all that oxygen that your body really requires in order to manage the light sleep and deep sleep process is then redirected into your gut to help you digest the food. Yeah. You can only use what you've got. And basically, our bodies rest better when it functions correctly, when it is nutritionally robust. Okay, and I want to focus on four key nutrients, a mineral, a prohormone, and two amino acids, which I think underpin nutrition that supports healthy stress management and quality sleep. And the first, I think will be no surprise to anybody, will be magnesium. Now, our magnesium intake has been declining dramatically for the last 100 years or so, in fact, probably before that, but certainly since the Industrial Revolution, we've seen our magnesium decline dramatically. There, probably about 100 years ago, it was about 450 milligrams and declining demonstrably. About the mid-1940s, we hit the 350 mark when the RDA levels were created. At our attempt to say what our society saw as a minimum for healthy productivity, 350 milligrams, but we continue to decline. Whereas now we're probably around about 225 milligrams. And there's a debate on at the moment as to whether that 350, 325, 300 should be reduced to 250 milligrams. Well, I think that's insane, but that is a debate that we're having at the moment. The fact of the matter is that magnesium, for me, underpins modern life. Every cell in your body relies on optimal levels of magnesium which to function. If you imagine your cell, there's magnesium on the inside and calcium surrounding it. For that cell to act, if it's a nerve cell, for that cell to fire, portals open and calcium floods the cell, a chemical reaction. The nerve cell fires, the muscle cell contracts. It's magnesium's job then to push calcium out of the cell. That cell can then rest. It can then repair. Suboptimal cellular levels of magnesium means there's not enough magnesium in the cell to push that calcium out. And that cell isn't fully emptied and therefore cannot fully relax and repair. But it's not just calcium that enters the cell and gets pushed out by magnesium. Toxins enter the cell, environmental toxins enter the cell and therefore need to be pushed out as well. So not only do we have hyperactivity in the cells because there's not enough magnesium to push calcium out, we also have cellular toxicity because there's not enough magnesium to push environmental toxins out as well. Magnesium is fundamental for cellular health. It's nature's relaxant. It helps us synthesize melatonin, activates the parasympathetic nervous system, binds to GABA receptors. It quietens our nerves, our nerve activity. It is just so fundamentally important. A study by University of Reading, looking at only 200 milligrams of magnesium, actually elevated quality of sleep for, it was a study of 79 patients, and three particular areas. First of all, enabling them to get to sleep quicker. The second benefit is being disturbed fewer times. And the third benefit is waking up fresher. And interestingly, there was a study that I was involved in with St. Mark's Hospital in Harrow, particularly investigating transdermal magnesium, magnesium applied onto the skin for patients with severe gastric disorders, so with suffering from Crohn's or celiac disease. They had shortened bowel stomas, had to go back into hospital every week for a magnesium infusion or intravenous injections. And there they were given transdermal magnesium, and not only were half of the patients able to come off their weekly infusions, but 100% of the patients benefited from the eradication of cramping. Severe magnesium deficiency means muscle cramping, and that can also disrupt sleep, restless leg syndrome being the classic example. But not all magnesium is created equal, and we hear a lot about magnesium at the moment on social media, about this form of magnesium for brain health, this form of magnesium for digestive function, this form of magnesium for sleep. It's not really necessarily the form of magnesium that dictates how it's used. It's the strength of the compound, the strength of the bond of the magnesium ion to the compound that dictates how well the body can use it. And not all compounds are created equal. The most bioavailable compound being magnesium chloride. It's got a very loose compound bond between the magnesium ion and its compound. It's virtually totally ionized. And the compound strength is called the stability constant. And it's less than 0.1. The worst being magnesium oxide. And I know a lot of people talk about magnesium oxide being important. And although it has a very high level of magnesium in it, 60% of the compound has elemental magnesium, but it's virtually insoluble. The bond is so strong that your body won't absorb that magnesium. So it's not necessarily the form of magnesium, it's the low stability compound, how bioavailable it is, that's important to understand. So find a level of magnesium, if supplementing, that you feel comfortable with, and that's the form that you should stick to. The next nutrient being vitamin D3. Now again, not a vitamin, it's actually a hormone or pro-hormone. Essential for bone health, but in this situation, we're talking about immune health. For your brain to really relax, you really need a good immune system. Vitamin D3 is fundamental. It's the most common deficiency we see today. Do you know, over 2 million prescriptions for vitamin D are written every month. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of who needs it. Now, daily supplementation is required. The vast majority of our vitamin D really comes from our skin's unprotected exposure to the UVB radiation from the sun. But the vast majority of our days are internal. And when we are outside, we have very, very little skin exposure. It's virtually impossible, unless you're an Inuit, unless you're an Eskimo, it's virtually impossible to eat your way out of a vitamin D deficiency. 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan. Now, it's not a protein. That's wrong. It's an amino acid derived from a protein. This is a great nutrient that is a precursor to serotonin. Serotonin being a wonderful hormone, the happy hormone. Reduces anxiety, elevates mood, and serotonin actually gives way to melatonin. So it's a nice way to just calm your brain prior to sleep. And the final nutrient, GABA. So gamma, aminobutyric acid, which regulates slow wave and light sleep, really, really nice, helps to modulate circadian rhythm, balance that sleep wake cycle, basically helps you fall asleep quickly and helps you elongate the sleep duration. So those four nutrients can be found in five key foods. First, whole grains, massively important. These five foods really need to underpin your daily nutritional intake. Whole grains, including oats, dark green veg, anything dark green, really massively important, particularly for magnesium intake. chlorophyll being made up by a lot of magnesium. Nuts and seeds particularly, I'm not talking about salted peanuts either, nuts and seeds, pulses. And finally, and we've heard it again today, oily fish. And particularly about oily fish, omega-3, vitamin D, very, very important source. Oily fish, important source of vitamin D. But if it's, let's say, wild Alaskan salmon, if it's farmed wild Alaskan salmon, you'll probably have half the vitamin D content than if it's wild Alaskan salmon. Farmed being contained, and you have a depth of fish activity with poor availability to the UVB radiation. So wild oily fish being preferable to farmed oily fish. Thank you very much indeed.
Brilliant. Three great talks there. Thank you very much. Over to the audience. Questions?
Got one here?
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask... there's a mic coming, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. Wanted to ask about the gender difference in the microbiome with your mice study. Did you sort of like see if the female mice had less food than the male mice? Did you sort of like measure how much they actually ate to see if there is a difference?
Yes, there was no differences in food intake, no.
This is for Katerina, very quickly. In your latest study, what was the percentage of responders?
In 20 people, we had 16 that responded, 4 that didn't.
Do you have any idea why the 4 didn't?
So we don't know, but it might be related. So one of the things that I didn't point out, you see that those 4 people already had a very high oxygenation response. So whether that's related to the fact that they were fitter, so they probably already had better diets. We did not measure cardiorespiratory fitness in this group of people or habitual diet, which was a mistake that I've learned from. But when you compare where they were getting to, they were already getting to the point that the other group on the flavonoids got to. So I think it might be related to that. Whether that's, you know, fitness, whether that's diet, I don't know.
Thank you.
Any more? Oh, great. One at the back.
Katerina, this question is for you. Sorry, I've missed a bit of the presentation. Not sure if I missed the information. You've mentioned that it's the flavonoid that you're referring, right? Is that a specific flavonoid? Referring to, or because it's flavonoids is a wide group of elements.
Yeah.
So are there any specific flavonoids that you have worked on?
So in most of these studies, I used flavonols from cocoa, which are the same ones that you can find in green tea, black tea, sort of similar compounds, yeah. I mean, cocoa is a good way of delivering this compound in a very controlled way with a proper placebo. And so that's why... when you're trying to show this kind of more mechanistic, it's a good way of doing it, yeah. But I have some studies with blueberries, for example, going on and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more? No? Sorry, Katrina, I had one more question, which was really about the variability in responses that you were showing. And have you got, you know, help? Can you explain some of that variability a bit more for us, where do you think the research then needs to go to sort of understand the implications of that variability?
I think the variability might be coming from a few places. One related to how people absorb these compounds. So if even within the same person consuming the same food today and tomorrow and in a few weeks, the amounts and the timings of absorption are different. So even within person. So then you have even a bigger variability between people. So, and we don't really understand why that's the case. But that really correlates well with some of these more acute benefits. If you have the compounds within circulation, the likelihood that you're going to get an effect is high, but not everybody will generate exactly the same compounds. So depending on the enzymes and the activity of your enzymes, etc. So that is a source of variability there. And I think that is a huge source of variability in who you are in terms of your habitual diet and in terms of how fit you are. Because if you have a diet that is already rich in flavonoids, chances are that you might not benefit, especially acutely, from having that, because you're already performing at a high level. It doesn't mean that, you know, the fact that you might not benefit acutely, that's probably because you're in a very good place, right? So it probably, it already build the resilience that you need against stress, against sitting for long periods of time, etc. But I think that is an aspect there. And there is some data that came from the biggest study that has been ever done in with cocoa flavonoids that showed exactly that, that only the people in the lowest quartile of flavonoid intake and quality of diet actually benefited from a three-year intervention with cocoa flavonol. So that's really, I think it's a big area that we're going to hear about a lot more about in the flavonoid field.
Perfect. And I mean, just to sort of, you know, we hear a lot of people talking about chapters of life, and within those chapters of life, behaviors don't always remain consistent, do they? So I think the point being that actually at certain stages, there may be in a positive state, but it doesn't mean to say that's predictive. It's somewhat predictive, but it's not always predictive. So those changes are dynamic in the nature.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just going to ask final question from, if we've got no more. Sorry, I'm hogging the mic. So to Matthew, I mean, I guess really, really interesting work, fantastic work. Where is your research going next around this sort of, you know, it appeared a lot of animal models you were talking about. Where next? You remain in the animal space or you sort of move, you know, there seems a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah, so unfortunately, obviously, I can't give you too much nutritional information there. Because it's such an emerging field. But yeah, where we're sort of going next is RCTs, particularly for the ones that look more promising. And that's particularly N3 polyunsaturated fatty acids. But also I'm trying to develop a more high throughput screening tool to test for different compounds, essentially, to see how that relates before, you know, taking it through to the other stages, have a really high throughput model, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you very much. I want to thank all our speakers. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. We've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Manchester in May, Ascot in October, and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. And we look forward to seeing you there.